Hey folks, Mark, Unsung, Chris, hi.
I really just want to start saying the words that are missing there.
It's like jazz.
From welcome back.
Do you know what it is?
Hello,
right?
You look lovely today.
Do you know what it is? Do you ever listen to Radio Lab, the podcast?
No.
They always do that. They just like come in like, hey, the person's name, Radio Lab, and that's it. And yeah. I'm like, that's cool.
It's so nonchalant, isn't yeah. it? Except you're not that nonchalant. You're trying to make it work.
I'm trying to change, man.
I've said the words that you're missing. I'm going to do a very creative cut, put together a proper intro to this show. Talking about proper intros, just in the downtime there where we attended to our bodily functions, Kel, you were letting slip that you're a bit of a bath man. And as I said, he doesn't like sitting in their own muck.
Yeah.
So what's the deal?
So basically, I sing about my love of baths an awful lot. Like, I'd say at least 10 or 11 of my songs take place within the bath.
Have you considered the concept record?
Yes. I'm hoping the next single that the band are going to release, hopefully, is going to be called Kafka
in the bath.
Which again is annoying. My friends said I should call it Bafka-esque, but
I think you should call it Lufa's Turn to Monsters.
So, but not enough other musicians sing about having baths.
Is something that's really blighting the Western world, isn't it?
I tried to make a playlist of bath songs. Standout.
Digital Bath by Deftones.
There we go. Standout of myself is Harry Nilsson has a song called Bath, which is about coming home from a night out and having a bath.
Does he?
Yeah. This morning, but I don't know where I've been. I'm going home to take my bath, but I'll be back again. Yeah, I'm leaving here this morning with a smile upon my face. So I'm beginning to think there's hope for the human race. I'm leaving.
Fucking legend.
What a legend.
It is an incredible song.
I'm more just meaning he came home for a night out and had a bath.
Yeah.
That's what makes him a fucking legend, mate. I have never in my fucking life come home from a heavy night out
and went, I need a bath.
I'm not going to lie, last night I was very close to having a bath at 4 a.m.
How much sin do you need to have committed to need to come home in the middle of the night and run a bath? Can you imagine the reaction of my housemate at 4 in the morning if I was running a big fucking bubble bath, getting some candles out?
I'd fucking fall asleep, man. I'd have flooded the place.
I'm like drowning.
The amount of times I've nearly succumbed in the bath is beyond.
Imagine whitening in the bath. It's one thing whitening in the shower. Imagine whitening in the bath.
I gained my love of baths from my father. Apparently seems to be in the genetics. He loved a bath.
Wow.
I do have traumatic memories though, of my dad passed out whited in the bath.
Oh, man.
Like being a wee guy going down bells. And dad just like,
this is up there with that story Dave Weaver told us when he found a jobby in the sink when he was on holiday and he couldn't work out who did it.
Nobody could.
And you're making a podcast about music. The podcast should be about that.
There is an offshoot.
Yeah.
So I've now started a new project though, in which at the start of the year I was watching Clockwork Orange. Uh-huh. And through all the mass violence and metaphors and whatever, there's a scene where Alex has a bath and I was watching it and I was like, I could do a bath like I could do a bath now. And then I realized that two of the, like, this must have been on like the 3rd of January, and the previous two films that I'd watched also had bath scenes, and I was like, somebody needs to start like a screen grab Twitter page. Anytime I watch a film and somebody has a bath, it needs to be
shining.
It needs to. I've done all the Kubrick. Kubrick does a lot of bath, man. There's like a scene in Lolita. The guy has
what lies beneath.
what an odd pull.
Well, it's on the cover of the.
On the bath, but yeah.
Saltburn.
So of course. So, but again, I was saying statistically. So I've watched 101 films this year so far. I've got 20 bath shots. Right. So,
have you watched? Wait a minute. Let's roll the fuck back for a sec here. It's
boys on a mission.
As of recording, the 17th of March.
I watch a lot of films. So you're talking like that's
so
like
you watch films in the bath.
Yes.
Right. So that makes a bit more sense. Yeah.
I also watch films at my work.
Ah, fair enough.
4 a.m. Been on a heavy night out. Come home, run a bath, put the shining on. Who doesn't
so
do that?
That's you're saying. Like, let's round it up. Say, like, so you're talking like 20%, 25%. Then, if I said last night, if we're throwing a set square here, that's like 20% of the films that I've watched, a large variety of genre. 20% I've got scenes in a bath. I've watched all of Kubrick's films this year. I watched all of Martin Scorsese's films.
Oh,
Martin Scorsese has 26 films. Only one of them has a bath scene.
What's he got against it?
Like, I was just like, statistically speaking, that is mental.
Maybe they're in the director's cuts.
Maybe.
Yeah. You know, something that just popped into my head. So I'm not a big bath guy. I do wash, but I'm not a big bath guy. But growing up, like, we didn't have a shower in my house, so I used to have baths all the time. And I just got a really vivid image of me doing that thing where you scoot back and forth to make the waves happen. And then the water starts to, like, slop up either side of the bath. And I was thinking, what a wee prick. Absolute wee prick. Being somebody with my own house now, I would never do that, even though it's fun. I would never do that in the bath now. How the fuck did my parents not beat the shit out of me for that? Just, I clearly remember doing that. So the waves got bigger and bigger till they were actually like, I can remember the sound of the water splashing on the deck. Mm. They must have been, my human. Parents must hate me.
Speaking of somebody who also owns their own house and owns a bath, it's still fun.
I wait till your Wayne starts doing it to you though, Kyle. Then you'll get your comeuppance, right?
For sure.
I only take a bath when I'm really hungover. I usually shower.
I've already had a bath today, and I've definitely scheduled one
this evening.
This evening,
we better crack on then.
keep me for his bath, right?
You got to draw a bath as well. Didn't you run a bath? Yeah,
you got to draw a bath.
Yeah, you get to a certain age, and you're like, no, don't run me a bath.
Draw me a bath.
Okay, so we're talking about Bright Eyes. We're talking about, well, the subject of the shows is digital ash in a digital urn. Until the clock speaks up. Says it's time to go. You can choose the high or the lower road. But we are in the midst of Bright Eyes' back catalogue.
Mm-hmm.
In the first episode, we talked a wee bit about the early history of the band, talked a wee bit about the vocal style, that dead, loose, sugary, emo-y kind of strangled thing that they do, which I suppose is a bit Marmite for some people, mm-hmm. but, you know, make your own mind up. We have just left off discussing Every Day and Every Night, the EP from 1999, which was produced by Mike Mogus and marked a bit of a change where you could hear more of the studio coming into the process. It wasn't quite so raw and simply song-based. So we're going to get on to what is a huge watershed, pardon the continuation of the theme, with Fevers and Mirrors, the album from the turn of the century, the turn of the millennium actually, 2000. Here's a scale, weigh it out, and you'll find these are we more than sufficient doubt. These colours you see were picked in advance by some careful hand with an absolute concept. This is when I came in on Bright Eyes. As I said, I got some downloads from Epitonic, and this contains Halai Halai, which was the track that sort of like really made me think, oh, maybe this is something I'm going to get really into. Mm. I really, really wanted to like this as an album. It was a big step forward. We'll talk about obviously this, but a big step forward in terms of maturity, first of all, in terms of the arrangements. They're much more complicated, but this guy, Connor in particular, has been writing and recording for a long time now, already at this point.
Almost a decade by this point.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So as I say, I tried really hard to get more into Bright Eyes in general. That Halai Halai tune, the hook in that had really caught me. Thank you and hang up the phone. Let the funeral start. Hear the casket close. Let's pin split black ribbon to your overcoat. There are some tracks in this that I think are amongst the other stuff by him that I like the best. I think Something Big, the fourth track in it, for example, is one of the other Bright Eyes songs that really pulled me in.
That's a phenomenal song. And not really sure what you do in this for, but you need something to fill up the day.
But let's look at some of the other tracks first, though. I mean, what stands out on this one for you?
Like, Something Vague is probably top tier. Again, if you're trying to get somebody into Bright Eyes and you want to show the production and you want to show Connor's lyrical style, that's like the invention of what becomes Bright Eyes tinged emo, basically, is the lyrics in Something Vague. For some reason, I think Fevers and Mirrors is probably my least favourite Bright Eyes album.
Interesting. Contrary.
Yeah. No, there's moments in it I love, and then there's moments in it where I think you can feel, again, them trying to find their way around the studio type of thing and being like going bigger and bigger and doing the kind of like weird musical theatre nods and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, this is on Rate Your Music, this is their third most highly reviewed album, but it's very, very close. It's like 0.5 points between this and Wide Awake and Lifted. It's really, really close. This is the album that kind of got me into Bright Eyes. Then I kind of didn't really get on with Lifted, so I kind of stopped listening to the band at that point. But like, this is, yeah, they're from a perspective of the arrangement. Like, they started bringing like fucking banjos and flutes and accordions, and you know, they started bringing like a lot more varied instrumentation.
Yeah, I think the fifth track, the movement of a hand, the electric piano in that is quite a step up as well.
Something Vague becomes quite kaleidoscopic towards the end. I think that's probably one of the strongest things about it. You know, it's a slow build, and usually in the past, I guess in the last two records, that would have just been like acoustic guitar, then full band. Mm-hmm. Whereas this is paced really, really nicely.
Yeah, there's in that song, this is 1:45, the steps up to the higher register. It's a really good transition. It doesn't always work as effectively as it does in that tune.
It's very Neutral Milk Hotel, 100%. Like, it reminds me of them. Hailey Halai, we can talk about that in a wee second. Centre of the World was a really good, I really like that song. It's more downbeat, kind of wallows in the misery a little bit. The organ kind of makes it feel that way. But I remember back when I was into this record, I really couldn't get on with the latter half of it, but I actually found myself enjoying the latter half more now. It does end really strongly. The Sunrise Sunset as well was, it's in a waltz, you know, it's got a kind of weird lilt to it.
As I'm saying, it's a musical theatre nod. It's it's a song from Fiddler on the Roof.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Okay.
Sunrise, the sunset, you're hopeful, then you regret. The circle never breaks. With a sunrise and a sunset, there's a change of heart or address. Is there nothing that remains?
Sunrise, sunset, sunrise, sunset, swiftly fly.
So it's it's a song from the Sunrise Sunset part is a direct lift from.
Oh, cool! That's good.
Fiddler on the Roof.
That's interesting. That's interesting to bring that in as well, isn't it?
Yeah. So it's like stuff like that. Like I enjoy it, but there's something like Centre of the World. For some reason, there's something too condensed. Like they've not found the space yet. Something Vague's a great little, as you said at the end of that. But I feel like sometimes it gets a bit condensed with the personnel. Like there's a lot going on and they've not managed to...
Just a bit crowded.
Yeah, they've not, like, Mogis hasn't learned to manage the chaos yet, and, like, it is chaos, and that's kind of what they are going for, but I think, like, managing the chaos is a talent that he kind of finds in the next album, basically.
Yeah. It's, I think the third track in this one, The Calendar Hung Itself, is an interesting one, because it's sort of aggro, but never actually heavy. And that's partly because of the production. I think it feels quite constrained so it goes for something that's got a bit of like angry energy to it, but it doesn't really have, it's never really able to broaden its horizons enough to get any real weight into the music, and so it's just a bit tepid.
Mm. Me and my dad's always kind of seen eye to eye on music, and then when I turned into kind of like an emo kid, he was kind of like annoyed because he was like, I don't like any of this stuff. And when I got heavy into Bright Eyes,
you get that fucking bath in
I got heavy into Bright Eyes. I remember playing this record, and when he heard The Calendar Hung Itself, he was like, who produced that? There's no way they worked with him again. And I was like, well, they did it themselves. But like, I totally get it. As
I'm
you
sorry
said,
with
like,
your dad on that one.
As you said, there's something, absolutely love The Calendar Hung Itself. But again, you can same again. It feels very crushed down and like maybe overmastered or something.
Mark, what did you want to say about Halai Halai? Other than it's a very good song.
It's a very good song. It's really atmospheric in the intro.
Atmospheric.
I don't know why did I say it like that.
I don't know. But again, this gives it an edge.
It brings us back to the Conor Oberst incredible pronunciation. And we're all over the place here. Pronunciation of the word.
Pronunciation
of the word.
Fucking hangovers are the fourth host today, aren't they?
Mirror. He says the word mirror funny.
I looked in the mirror.
And he speaks about mirrors. A lot,
yeah. No, it's a really great song.
It's the full title, Halai, Halai, Alai, Halai.
Yeah, yes. Aye. Right, so I was listening to this with my headphones on, like when I say it's atmospheric, there's like a dial tone for a phone in the background and somebody walking around, and I fucking thought somebody was in my house when I had my headphones on, because it's the way that it's totally captured in the room, and I was like, what the fuck, is somebody in my house? Somebody was not in my house. But then the whole band comes in and all that shit goes away. The re-record's got Phoebe Bridgers on it and it's really, really good. Well, but yeah, I love the Rhodes piano on that song in particular. Mm-hmm. I love a Rhodes piano, to be fair. So
yeah,
I'm still a sucker for the fake radio interview as well.
That I was going to mention that. That is really, really good. Yeah.
So long, everything he shouted. Then he ran next door to
Marco's
house. I'm moving, he said.
Who's it? Somebody.
It's someone doing an impression of him. Mm. It's not actually Conor Oberst.
Your five brothers. they all died, or
yeah.
Or my mum used to kill them in the bathtub. Or something like that.
Yeah, he likes a wee novelty opening, doesn't he?
That's a feature, isn't it?
That's a feature. Yeah, yeah. A feature again. I've taken for my own as well. Every collection I have has a stupid opening, like a noise based opening. I believe that's the thing where he says though they put them in because they want to scare off people who think it's going to be an easy listen, and it's like, shut up. Like, again, I absolutely love Bright Eyes. They're like my life and soul, but
nah.
You're not quite
insert eye roll emoji. So 2002, Lifted, or The Story Is In The Soil, Keep Your Ear To The Ground.
Across electric wire, it's a baited line, yeah. The hook's in deep, boys. There's no more time, so you could struggle in the water, be too stubborn to die, or you could just let go and be lifted.
71 minute album, eh?
Catchy.
Yeah. Mm. This is the most popular album on
Sold
Radio
a quarter
Music.
Million at the time. Mm.
Mm-hmm. The vibes are far different in this record than anything that's come before.
Well, what I think's interesting is that perhaps some of the reason for that is that the band had broken through into everything from Rolling Stone to Spin to NME to even like the New York Times were writing about them. And at that point, which isn't something they'd really reckoned with prior, there was a lot of expectation. I mean, yeah, they had a sort of lower level following, but they didn't have this sort of Media Darling's late night talk show.
Yeah, I think that was the beginning of the new Bob Dylan type of thing.
Yeah, like. Yeah.
And that must change the way you approach a record when you're like, shit, all these people are waiting on me to say something. It needs to count. And with this one, even the 71 minute thing, it's like, you just throw everything at the wall and fucking hope you get it right somewhere.
It's very ambitious. The poster sounds so many ways.
Again, I'd say that I absolutely love Lifted. Mm. I think it's like I could listen to it on loop forever and never, never.
Yeah, the big chamber pop vibes on this record. They're like with the strings. It's just like, I was not like, I didn't get into it when it came out.
You say chamber pop?
Chamber pop.
Oh, this is chamber pot.
Chamber pot
is like,
keep that next to the bath.
Yeah, you piss in it and tuck it under the bed.
Yeah, no, chamber pop.
Wow, that was really misheard.
pop.
Chamber pop. Yeah. I don't think I've ever heard of that.
You know?
Chamber quartet.
No, like chamber pop, like what's the other, there's baroque pop, that kind of
thing. Surely chamber pop is too close to chamber pop for it to have caught on as a saying.
I'm assuming maybe. That's probably why they went for baroque pop.
Yeah, probably.
But now I say baroque pop, I'm not enjoying saying that at all.
Yeah, the strings are basically what give it that sort of chamber feel.
The, again, thing that I learned from that documentary I keep mentioning as well is there's not a drummer on it. It's,
really?
It's a drum core.
The rain had started tapping on the window near my bed. There was a loophole in my dreaming, so I got out of it. And to my surprise, my eyes were wide and already open. Just my nightstand and my dresser.
Every single track's a drum core. There's not just one drummer.
Was that like an army of drummers?
Yes. So like one person's playing the kick, one person's playing the snare. So that's why the drums are insane.
That's odd, but wow, okay, that's an interesting decision.
Yeah.
I remember when I was getting that batch of stuff in the early days, so this is 2002, I remember downloading the second track, Method Acting, but I never really, that song just never really took me. And I find, you know, as I was saying earlier on, with his vocal sometimes being a bit Marmite, that bit in it on and on and on and on. Oh. God, it fucking did my box in that wee bit. And I think that is, I'm too close to the edge of irritation sometimes with Bright Eyes to really be a fan. Mm. I mean, I think the eighth track in this one, nothing gets crossed out. I can really hear that bigger production you're talking about.
Ellie Smith vibes all over that song.
Somewhat, yeah, but actually the thing I hear more is Arcade Fire, mm-hmm. Early Arcade Fire, when at that time as well, when Wynn Butler was doing the Fragile vocal as well, because he is another person that uses that technique.
Yeah.
But yet their chamber pop was more of a thing, you know, it was a more strings, it was a more fleshed out production.
Escalation and elevation.
So that's the comparison that really jumped out to me. And I like that because I like Arcade Fire, but I'm not sure that I particularly like this song or the songs.
I think this Nothing Gets Crossed Out is an interesting one to pick out because it's very restrained and pared back, and Older Bright Eyes would not have done that. It would have been a point where he's shouting towards the end of the song, even though it's quite a quiet song.
Nothing gets crossed out that's got the false stop in it, doesn't it? Love it.
Other things that stood out for me, false advertising, that's when you really see the orchestra in full force. It really reveals that chamber pop feel. Mm-hmm. And it's got a big blooming chorus, and it's, you know, really slow and methodical. It feels more like a movie soundtrack than a emo lo-fi band at this point. And this record couldn't be further from lo-fi. It really could not be further from it. You will. That's the name of the song. That takes us right back to a kind of more stripped back sound.
Are you the love of my lifetime? Cause there's been times I've had my doubts. We were just kids when I first kissed you in the attic of my parents' house.
Echoes the lo-fi roots. It sounds like Connor's sitting inside a reverb tank for that one. It's like they're trying to ape what the lo-fi sound would have been in a kind of much more hi-fi kind of way. The mandolin, organ, piano and accordion are just mixed really well. It feels like REM when the whole band come in, that one.
For just like the last few bars of the song, it's incredible.
Yeah, love I don't have to love. It's just fucking brilliant. There's something kind of sinister about it. The drums kind of feel like a hip hop beat. I now knowing that multiple people are playing the different drum parts, it's fucking mad. The stabs of the strings that come in, it reminds me of, well, no, the whole song kind of reminds me of Sick Transit Glory by Brand New, but that came 2 years later. Mm. So maybe they took, because the kind of creeping nature of it, the kind of sort of sinister way that kind of weaves through. Yeah, that's a really good song. And Let's Not Shit Ourselves, it's just really good as well.
Well, the animals laugh from the dark of the wilderness. A baby cries hard in an apartment complex as I pass in a car buried under the influence.
Again, another song that I think I owe everything that everything that I do as a songwriter, I owe a lot to that song. Basically, like, I can probably pull a few songs off of my like hard drive of just being like, there's me trying to do that.
It goes in many different directions, that song, which is good, and it's really long. It's like 10 minutes long as well. Oh, I really enjoyed that record, actually. Like, I wasn't expecting to, because it's when I fell out with them before.
I was going
to
say, you said that it didn't register with you initially.
But I did really enjoy it.
Can't believe you didn't mention Bully Oranges.
Oh, fuck.
He said, oh, yes, you can. Just hold my hand. I think that would help. So I sat with him a while. Then I asked him how he felt. He said, I think I'm cured. No, in fact, I'm sure.
Bowl of Oranges.
Yeah, Bowl of Oranges is also a really good song.
It's like, I'd say, yeah, that's like the top tier, again, of like Bright Eyes. I'd say it's like, You Will, Bowl of Oranges, Lover I Don't Have to Love, Let's Not Shit Ourselves. Like, I think they are
top Bright Eyes.
Yeah.
So you follow that with a Christmas album, do you?
Yeah, I didn't actually listen to a Christmas album because it's no Christmas, so.
Yeah, I mean, that's a question of judgment.
God rest you.
You know all the songs anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I don't want to hear Conor Bass doing those songs, really.
I mean, it is exactly what it is.
It is a banger.
it's fucking Christmas carols and Christmas.
Yeah, they don't really change much of it. There's like some kind of like maybe starting to get like digital ash energy in that. Mm. There's some kind of like knob twiddling.
Did we mention this when we did the Christmas album thing on the Christmas show? No, because I mean, this is a prime example of that. Yeah,
I was going to say, actually, is this a total sidebar? But like, you're talking about the Christmas album. One of the things that we often try and do in the podcast is try to bring in people who know a lot about an artist to talk about an artist. And Bright Eyes have been one of those bands that have been hanging about for ages that we just know we need to talk about. That's the reason why it never came up in a Christmas episode, because like none of us listen to Bright Eyes. But it seems like a pure stick on for that. It's good to actually be able to now be able to probably bring that up this Christmas and go, hey, there's a Christmas album. But
cross it off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like Jenny Lewis does lots of the vocals in it, and I love Jenny Lewis, so that was her. She'd kind of like sneaked her way into that scene around about that time. So
did Christmas album, did that come out the same year as Lifted?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's really interesting, because up until this point, they've released two albums every year. They've released an album.
Oh yeah.
which is quite strange. It was cool, but it's kind of, and they obviously continue that tradition for the next couple of records as well.
So in 2004, they toured with Bruce Springsteen and nodding back to a comparison you made earlier on, Mark, REM, on the Vote for Change tour. They also duetted with Neil Young at that time. This is like a kind of...
That actually makes sense.
Yeah, vocally, it does. I think. It does. I mean, he really, really into his collaborations at some point as well. But I mean, those are big fucking names. You're now in the sort of A-class musical celebrity sort of circles. You can pretty much call anybody up and be like, do you want to be on the next record when you're fraternizing with these kind of people? 2005 is obviously when Digital Ash and A Digital Urn came out. But at the same time as that, they released I'm Wide Awake, It's Morning. Big album. Thoughts?
It's a great album. That's it.
Good. Moving on.
They become a country band.
Yeah.
They become a country band at this point.
Yeah, I think the first one in that, At the Bottom of Everything, is kind of charming enough. It's got that kind of authentic pub folk feel.
Must talk in every telephone, get eaten off the web. Must rip out all the epilogues from the books that we have read. Into the face of every criminal, strapped firmly to a chair.
You know, a little bit of Bob Dylan in it as well. Was that the track that was recorded at his pub?
I'm not sure.
Yeah,
not
so
sure.
I think he bought a pub.
Connor.
Like, it's called something like Page Turner's Rest or something like that. And I think this track was recorded live in the pub with an audience of people.
Yeah, that's cool. I called him Connor there because he's my close personal friend, obviously.
Yeah, clearly. The vocal harmony in this one is both kind of odd, but also oddly effective. I quite like what they did with the backing vocal in that.
While my mother waters plants, my father loads his gun. He says death will give us back to God, just like the setting sun.
It's got a kind of vaguely Boston Irish thing again that sort of brought me back to Tugalance. Yeah. And it's that twist on country. It's not really massively American sounding country to me. It's something of the Atlantic, you know, transatlantic kind of country.
I mean, when I say they become a country band, on this record it's more all country.
Mm-hmm.
Casadega is when they become a proper country band.
Yeah,
I mean, on this record, for the highlights, so The First Day of My Life is just a really good song. I think objectively it's a good song.
Yours is the first face that I saw. I think I was blind before I met you. And I don't know where I am, I don't know where I've been, but I...
So this is, as you said earlier on, this is the biggest track for this band. This is the one you hear in a lot of sync.
Is it hundreds of millions of plays on Spotify? It charted at 37 in the UK charts, which is completely unheard of for Bright Eyes. Even James fucking Corden chose it for his Desert Island Discs and Radio 2. That's how big this song is.
That is not a badge of honour.
But I'd rather be working for a paycheck than waiting to win the lottery. Besides, maybe this time is different. I mean, I really think you lie.
This is probably peak Conor's best songwriting, I think, for this era. His voice is much, much improved by this point in his career. That wobbliness is going away slowly. He sounds a lot more confident. The re-recorded version with the EP that came out has got a full band. It's a full band version of the song.
And it sounds so strange. You said everything changed. You felt as if you just... And you said, this is the first day of my life.
It's really, really good. It's much more country, but it's good to hear a completely different version of it, completely recontextualised. It actually has some synths and electronics in it, so it actually feels like it could have been in Digital Ash.
I think the way they try to approach those re-releases is they flip the right, idea.
That totally makes sense.
Yeah, so like the idea is like all the tracks I'm Wide Awake are done like Digital Ash, and then all the songs from Digital Ash are done like...
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. That does make sense, given that the two albums have such different feels to them, yeah. Mm.
Blue is... I prefer that song to First Day of My Life. I think it's a better song.
And I know you have a heavy heart,
I can feel it when we kiss. So many men stronger than me have thrown their backs.
The lyrics are fucking brilliant. Okay, as soon as I heard that song when I was in research for this, I just picked it up and learned it in guitar straight away, because that's how much I enjoyed it immediately. It's kind of more in line with the emo stuff as well, which is cool. Mm. Obviously totally my bag. Another travelling song, a true country song, it's even got the country beat in Liberal Helpings of Pedal Steel, and you know I fucking love Pedal Steel.
Yeah.
Until we're parking in an alley, just hoping our shit is safe. So I go back and forth forever.
All my thoughts, they've always had the kind of country tinge all over everything, like as you said, even going back to Letting Off the Happiness, whether it was kind of like more country punk or whatever, but it's always been there. And Mike Mogus, he's in a band called Lullabies for the Working Class, who are very just a country, an old country band basically. I think he's always probably pushed Connor in that direction. So I think, and then obviously touring with Neil, playing with Neil Young and playing with Bruce Springsteen or whatever, I think they were just at a stage where they were like, oh, we can do that now.
Yeah. We can hang
like, I think that was like one of the things they said. They were like writing it, and it was like, and then it could have like a Emma Lou Harris type style, like in Grand Parson, like,
well, that's
a backing vocal.
They're not from a coast, you know, so they've got a kind of authentic sort of Midwest appeal as well. And so incorporating traditional country influences, it doesn't feel contrived.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then they just decide, well, let's get actually Emily Harris.
Yeah, they were like, well, we're at a stage now, you don't need to get someone who sounds like Emily Harris, you can just ask Emily Harris and she'll do it.
The last one I wanted to bring out was Landlocked Blues, because that's got that solo singer-songwriter country thing, which Bruce Springsteen does and Neil Young does, and it's just really, really good.
I found a liquid cure from my landlocked blues. It will pass away like a slow parade. It's leaving.
The melody itself is very country. It's very different from what Bright Eyes are doing at this point. Kind of lazy Americana, which I really like about it. And I think, yeah, the re-recording is even better than the re-recording The First Day of My Life, because it is full on electronic and it's really fun. No guitars, no drums, just big reverby keyboards. It's pretty cool.
So it's interesting as well that when they did that tour, they toured part of it. Half the tour was for the first record and half the tour was for the second record as well. Like and rather than mixing them up, which kind of further makes the fact that Pitchfork couldn't review the album separately even more ridiculous. But when the band can even tour them separately, but yeah, there you go. And obviously we're going to come back to Digit Lash and Digital Learn in detail shortly, but Casadega, that you mentioned a little bit a minute ago, Mark, 2007.
It's kill or be killed.
It's got to number 4 in the States, so it's the biggest commercial album. The band on tour, I think, had swelled to about 12 members as well. A couple of tracks in this one that stood out to me, quite really, both really early on. The first one, Clear Audience, the string work on it really demonstrates how far they are from the minimalist approach. The strings in this sound like a 1940s Hollywood film.
You do,
like,
yeah.
Like really that kind of Hollywood climax. I mean, it's overcooked for me, but it's definitely going for that. And the second one, Four Winds, the production on it is just super clean and really pro, quite slick. Like it does feel like it's transitioned into emo country, you know, more fully at that stage.
But I don't know what you think, Kel, but I think Four Winds is a top tier, right? I
saw. Yeah, no, definitely.
But when great Satan's gone, the whore of Babylon, well, she just can't.
the vocal reminds me of Rivers Cuomo in places, which is quite interesting. It's got a really long intro, which is weird for a single.
The single version does not.
Does it not?
No. Like, it's an odd one, like, because I'm assuming it's the only Bright Eyes song that probably has a...
A single version?
Has a single version, like a radio cut.
Yeah, because it's like a minute and a half of an intro.
Yeah, like, they definitely, yeah. It's just like, they just do the riff, like, once or twice, and then they're like, bring those vocals in. So when you listen to it on the album, you're like... Nope, we're going again.
No, I mean, it was a really good decision for them, being how big they are, to actually do this is like the commercial record, this is the big commercial album, you know, and having that as the single on it makes all the sense in the world.
Also, I don't know if, I'm assuming everyone's just streaming now, the artwork with Dynamite, because it's obviously about like communing with the dead and blah, blah, blah.
I didn't know that.
It's got a key code thing, so it's like the artwork's all just black and white dots, and then you got like a little magnifier thing.
Oh, right, that allowed you to kind of like translate the picture.
Yeah.
That's fun, which
was Dynamite.
Yeah,
they had a few things like that. I've failed to bring that up earlier, but like with Fevers and Mirrors, there's again footage of them because Saddle Creek was still DIY to an extent. There's like footage of them all doing like an overnight, having to put mirrors into the record sleeve and like seal them up because it's an actual reflective surface on the vinyl. So
that's fun. Other tunes, Hot Knives, really good song. The drums are really cool, actually. They're quite busy, but they work really well for me.
The world was not of interest, though the days were never dull.
It's Janet from Sleater-Kinney.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's cool. I didn't know that. And Coat Check Dream Song is really dreamy, kind of experimental, kind of echoes Digital Ash. It's quite melancholic and introspective. Actually reminds me of Cursive in places, that song. Mm-hmm.
Tugs at my senses, big as the Macy's parade. One brick on top of another, such is the measure of man. Planets are...
The multiple female backing vocals towards the end are a really nice touch too. But I think it's a good record. I don't think it's the strongest record.
I think the moments where it's good, it's top of the line. Mm-hmm. And then I said there's parts where it can seem a bit like he's losing his direction a bit to an extent. I think maybe just before this, they released an EP called Tourist Trap, which had a song in it called called Endless Entertainment, and I think that's like in the similar energy of Four Winds, and as you said, like the total clean production.
Feels rich, baby, but tell me who is gonna pay for braces to make straight all that cold game. Keep my white teeth in sense. My smile is
That's one of the albums, you know. I'm happy with 70 minutes for Lifted, but I feel like Casadega could maybe have pushed itself along a bit with some tracks.
So there's a record that I didn't actually see a lot about at first blush, but that kind of stood out to me in the long run. 2010, they did One Jug of Wine, Two Vessels, which is a split EP on Crank, the label Crank, with the band Neva De Nova. Re-released as an album later on with extra tracks by Saddle Creek. I'd never heard this before, but I honestly think it's among the strongest stuff I've heard by Bright Eyes.
Dropped into the earth, the sad sound we ever heard. We sang along. We sang it.
Hey. I'd need to go and listen a bit more, but I'd seen so little about it. But yet, when I actually started listening to it, for, you know, the first track in it, Roller Skating, has a kind of 80s post-punk thing. There's a lot of like processing on the guitars.
Ain't no reason to be sad. There ain't no cause for us to worry.
It's very direct and driving. Vocally, it's kind of got the melancholy of Pedro the Lion. You know, the guy Jake Bellows that sings in this band, he takes the lead here, and there's a similarity there. But again, some of the energy is quite like that as well. The second track, Happy Accident, this one's fronted by Connor.
Too much time for the self-employed. I heard you scream.
And it's actually a really strong, lush wee indie track with a lot of like Sparkle Horse vibes. So it's actually quite an intriguing little record. And I was confused as to why it wasn't maybe slightly higher profile, but worthwhile.
Yeah, yeah. I think a few of them appear on the Noise Floor, the rarities and stuff. Yeah. So
2011, The People's Key.
Dreamt I was riding on a motorbike. Lion of Judah painted on the side.
Kind of average reviews.
They sound tired as a band at this
yeah,
point.
They're trying something a bit different. I'm just not sure it actually hits the mark. I noticed that Connor was quoted as saying, we're over the Americana, rootsy, whatever that sound is. People say country, but I never thought we were very country at all. I guess it's worn a little thin for me these days, so we very much wanted it to be rocking and, for lack of a better term, contemporary or modern. It's an odd sounding record, maybe a little bit kind of struggling for an identity at it. I mean, the first one on it, Firewall, actually sounds like a weirdly postmodern Beatles to me, especially with the vocal effects that are used.
The classicist, the posture and avant-garde. I bought a grey McCaw named Tim Jules Verne. Probably me.
And I think like the third one, Jejun Stars, which is a single, a video and stuff, it's much more rocking and direct than a lot of the recent stuff. It's not too bad.
Any expression of love is a way to return.
The muted guitar stuff in the verse is really nice, but the song itself never really, it promises that it's going to lift off into like a big soaring chorus thing. It just never quite gets there.
I feel like Jejun, as you're saying, they sound tired. Like I feel like you can tell that he's maybe reaching for other things. Like I think like Jejun Stars is more close to like the Desperado stuff.
Yeah,
I guess like with Casadega, they obviously did massive like worldwide tour, as you said, with how many other people on stage. They all wore white suits for some reason. So I think after however long doing that, I think they were kind of just...
It was 4 years between the Casadega and this. So that's a long time.
Like I think that, and that was probably spent touring, you know what I mean? So I think they're at a stage where it makes sense, obviously, why they went on a hiatus.
Well, that's exactly
directly
it.
After it, you know, which I think is...
We've got the advantage of that to kind of say is the fact that they then embarked on a lengthy hiatus tells us that something wasn't completely right. Like they either weren't happy with the situation, a bit fatigued, weren't happy with the album, maybe a combination of all of these things. Yeah, so the band effectively stopped. They all pursued other things for almost a decade. So yeah, I mean, I think that gives us quite a bit of insight that probably wasn't there immediately when the record came out. But as I said, it was quite indifferently reviewed.
Yeah.
As well.
It's less personal, this record, and as a result, it lacks personality vocally and lyrically. One of the things that makes Bright Eyes really enticing, I think, is the fact that it feels as though you're having a conversation when you're listening mm-hmm. to it. You know what I mean? It feels as though you're actually getting to know the person behind the music.
I think that's also Casadega, probably, is also the beginning of, you know, Connor kind of going down. He's more like Leonard Cohen, obtuse. Like it stops being really personal and like really direct and starts to be a bit more obtuse and poetic and over the place, and that kind of then shows up more in his solo stuff as well. It's all very you know, there's tracks later on that he wrote under for films or stuff like that where, you know, he's trying to find a feeling, write a song about this, find a feeling, right, rather than just what he's... And I guess that's like, if that's what you're known for, then you can, again, like we're saying with this album, get tired of maybe putting yourself into that box type of thing.
I mean, after the bit in hiatus, he did how many solo albums?
He done like, I think there's like one or two under his own name. Then he had like the Mystic Valley Band. I think they've got like two or three albums, maybe.
And there's a Better Oblivion Community Centre as well with Phoebe Bridgers.
It's a lot of side projects.
Yeah.
It's a lot of ways to kind of dilute your output as well. You know, you can try different things, but also you're spreading yourself pretty thin as a songwriter at that point.
I know the Better Oblivion Community Centre record was really well received.
So the solo stuff There's one the first solo album he done has some absolutely beautiful songs at the opening track, and that's called Cape Canaveral. That's like,
oh yeah, I've heard that.
Absolutely beautiful song.
Oh, 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 brother totem pole, I saw your legends lined up, and I never felt more natural. Apart, I just came apart.
Then the Mystic Valley Band stuff again has moments here and there, but again, even as like a massive Conor Oberst fan, I'm like kind of scraping the barrel to find, like, if you were like, what's your favourite Mystic Valley Band song, I'd be like the last one that we don't listen to. But I'd say Better Oblivion Community Centre is a fantastic album, and I think it's finding his kind of get up and go again type mojo of thing.
I think working with somebody who's younger and a lot more hungry can really help rejuvenate an artist's sound. Hot Water Music are finding that just now by bringing Chris Cresswell into the band. It's like, right, giving them a whole new lease of life. I'm working with Phoebe Bridgers because she's all over a lot of these re-recordings, mm-hmm, as well. Her voice is all over them. So it's clear that he finds, she's very prolific anyway. There's definitely a kindred spirit there, I think.
Did he get his mojo back when he brought out Down in the Weeds Where the World Once Was, post hiatus?
To an extent.
Oh, it's interesting, this record, because this is the first record that was written collaboratively as Bright Eyes. This, right, was not just Connor. And Flea plays bass in it, and John Theodore plays drums,
yeah,
on it.
Yeah, I'd seen that he collaborated with him.
I read God's dead, I shed some tears for him, but I swear on his grave I'll never do it again. And I screamed when I realized what was happening, that I had good news of greed.
Fucking Flea's bass playing's outstanding on this record. It's really fucking good, as you would imagine, and John Theodore smashes it as well.
See, I mean, the production in general is big. The vocal production is much bigger, more roomy, really reverby in a way that I haven't heard them attempt before. He holds on to that really expensive sounding string production in this, retains big strokes of lap steel.
There's a bagpipe solo.
There's a bagpipe solo. It's in Persona Non Grata.
Looks like he might start crying. This is something that I said. Let's take a walk around the block. This fleeting feeling's infinite.
It does at the core sound like the same songwriters, but piped through a much bigger, grander machine. You know, more influences coming to bear, more studio time, which is fine. I mean, the project has matured, but I feel when I listen to this record, there's a lot of production added to some quite lukewarm songwriting. Like, for example, the Stairwell song, the fourth one.
They're talking about the weekend, all the plans that they have made. Said it's just nice to have something to anticipate.
It's an inoffensively nice tune that's fine. It's Bright Eyes writing Bright Eyes, but then it's very decorative and the production is a little bit OTT, as though he doesn't have the same faith in it as he had in some of the earlier stuff where he was comfortable with it being a bit,
yeah,
more
definitely
naked.
You were smart, but so foolish with your heart. At the exit from the start, in the end, couldn't tell what she pretended.
And I think the seventh one, Hot Car in the Sun, it kind of stood out again, though, maybe because it reminded me a lot of Arcade Fire and Wynn Butler's delivery as well.
It's just painful to walk around, it's just painful to talk out loud, I know. This pain is not my own.
I like Mariana Trench. It reminded me of Desaparecidos, actually.
From that album, that Mariana Trench is probably the standout track, and I think is well one of the ones that's like they really pushing the live show now as well.
Yeah.
So I wrap my head in bandages from a string of happy accidents. I guess maybe I asked for it, but who am I to say? The closing
got a kind of 80s synthy feel to it in places, which is really nice. John Theodore's beat is really unorthodox. Flea Dart's in with some really nice counter melodies and bass, which is just, they just never had in any other record. Like when he's playing paired back, he sounds like Paul McCartney and the Beatles, but then sometimes he'll just chuck in like wee runs, which just really sort of elevate the melodic payoff, you know. Dancing Sing's also a really good song as well, I think.
Now all I can do is just dance on through. See the Coast Guard come and save the drowning men out by Catalina Island, they banish it.
You think?
I think, yeah.
I'm not decided.
And Cali to Dover as well. That's quite a fun song. Some nice instrumentation, really well chosen percussion and guitar sounds.
So it kind of brings us up to date.
So I guess we'll just take a wee pause there. And then in the next episode, we can go and talk about the album.
Ah, yeah. Itself. Before we get diving right into the full meat of Digital Ash and the Digital Learn, sure thing. Kyle, you got another part in you?
No.
Hang in there, boyo. Go and get him like the hair of the dog.
Yeah.
See you next
See you soon.
Episode.
Yeah.